Thermonuclear weapons. The big guns. The purified uranium that fuels them has to come from somewhere. And that's what Nuclear Fuel Services, known as NFS, is planning to manufacture in Erwin, Tennessee. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has given it a thumbs up. Congress has already apportioned $57.5 million for it. And everything looks like it's a done deal. But when concerned citizens point at the health impact radiation releases from the site in the past has already had on the local population, the nukesters push back with a loud, "Prove it! Where's your epidemiological study of the effect on the people of Erwin?" And they think they've shut down the argument. But then, a world-class expert on the damage radiation does to human DNA based on age and gender comes to speak to a local event, and she tells them,
"Epidemiology is not something you can do with a tiny little town like Erwin, nor should we expect to do it in a tiny little town like Erwin. It is a false weapon of the nuclear industry and their shills in government to say we have to prove each time that radiation is harmful. We know radiation is harmful. We have already proved it, and we should be taking the findings from other places where there's larger numbers and applying them in Erwin, just like all my colleagues who work on climate."
Well, when Mary Olson of Gender and Radiation Impact Project takes aim at the tactics and strategies used by pro-nuclear interests to stifle the radioactive truth of a community like Erwin, and she's joined by four other genuine experts on a wide range of nuclear subjects who speak their truth, you get a clear view of the David and Goliath battle we are forced to wage over that terrible seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, the story of Erwin, Tennessee, where the U.S. government is prepared to spend $57.5 million on purifying uranium for the use in thermonuclear weapons. But it's unnecessary because that work is already being done at the Y-12 nuclear facility in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, only 109 miles away from Erwin. Local activists in the Erwin Citizens Awareness Network oppose this new increase in nuclear fuel production in their town. So they pulled together a powerful one-day People's Hearing for Nuclear Awareness with five world-class experts, all of whom will be on the show today. Attorney Terry Lodge, Dr. Michael Ketterer, evolutionary biologist Mary Olson, plowshares activist Patrick O'Neill, and Mari Inouye, Esquire. Each has compelling information on exactly how allowing NFS to process this uranium is dangerous, unnecessary, and wrong. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than was perp-walked in New York City today. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 4th, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting here in the U.S., where it's been discovered that several key buildings at the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Station in Northern California are constructed in the same flawed manner as concrete buildings with soft first floors destroyed in the recent Turkish earthquakes. In a comparable quake, could Diablo Canyon's buildings collapse? Assurances from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that the plant is seismically safe only address whether the reactors or spent fuel pools will release radiation into the environment in an earthquake, not whether the plant itself could continue operating. More U.S. nuclear problems, as reported by Ed Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. The NRC found multiple violations at the Fitzpatrick nuclear plant in New York State, including failure to conduct preventive maintenance on a safety-related emergency service water valve. The Hatch 2 nuclear reactor in Georgia was manually scrammed, emergency shutdown, after both recirculation pumps failed. McGuire 2 reactor in North Carolina had problems with their feed water, which is what cools the reactor. DTE Energy discovered a design flaw in the control system of their nukes that renders them incapable of operating during a design basis tornado. The Comanche Peak nuclear plant in Texas had 4 violations and multiple weaknesses identified, with failures to correct safety problems. And some of their personnel felt they could not raise issues without fear of retaliation. And there's so much more. Follow Ed Lyman on Twitter to get your daily updates on problems at U.S. nuclear reactors. In Japan, new images from inside the Fukushima reactor have sparked safety concerns, as pictures taken by a robotic probe in Unit 1 showed exposed steel bars in the main supporting structure and parts of its thick external concrete wall missing, triggering concerns about its earthquake resistance in case of another major disaster. Fukushima Governor Masao Uchibori urged TEPCO to, quote, swiftly evaluate levels of earthquake resistance and provide information in a way prefectural residents can easily understand to relieve concerns of the residents and people around the country. In Ukraine, Rafael Grossi, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said that the proposal to create a safe zone around the Zaporizhzhia 6 nuclear reactor site have fallen apart, and it looks like the proposal is dead. In an interview on PBS NewsHour, Grossi also said that a nuclear accident is, quote, entirely possible as long as the Zaporizhzhia site is occupied by Russians. And Australia has signed an agreement to acquire 3 nuclear-powered conventionally armed submarines from the United States by the early 2030s. Australia, the UK, and the US have said the deal complies with their nuclear non-proliferation obligations. But China has said the deal represents, quote, the illegal transfer of nuclear weapon materials, making it essentially an act of nuclear proliferation, which is prohibited by the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now here's the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter.
Animals are exposed to radiation too, Mitsue Kano reminds us in a powerful new video testimonial. Kano was a forced Fukushima evacuee, and she recounts her story of human suffering as part of a new video series, Voices of Nuclear Victims. You can find these stories under that title on YouTube. Humans really do atrocious things, Kana says, recording how she saw a wild boar running and vomiting blood during a brief visit back to her old house in the still radioactive area near the Fukushima nuclear plant. Animals have no idea that a nuclear accident has occurred, she says, and continue to be exposed to radiation. So too is the fate of the animals left in the Chernobyl exclusion zone, both wild and domestic, including cats and dogs abandoned by their owners who fled the April 1986 Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster. If you are a "if the dog dies, I'm not watching the movie" kind of person, you probably found the episode in the TV drama series Chernobyl, in which young soldiers are sent in to shoot those abandoned pet dogs and cats, hard to take. It's small comfort, perhaps, that some of them survived. Their descendants have a hard and truncated life, preyed on by wolves, foraging for food, and dependent on the kindness of humans to feed them, including Chernobyl plant workers and visiting research teams. And of course, more recently, these animals and their human carers have had to contend with living in a country at war, with an invading Russian army occupying the Chernobyl plant early on in the conflict, and leaving behind them a path of destruction that churned up the topsoil, heightening the levels of radioactivity in the environment. Those who do care for some 700 dogs and at least 100 cats include a charity, the Clean Futures Fund, which, among other projects, feeds, vaccinates, and spay-neuters these animals and provides basic veterinary needs. And a team of researchers, including an American, Timothy Mousseau, a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina, has been studying these dogs as well. In their latest published study, Mousseau's research team has found distinct markers amongst the dogs who live in identifiable family groups and that will allow them to begin the important examination of whether their DNA has been damaged by prolonged exposure to radiation in their environment. Mousseau, who also works with the Clean Futures Fund to ensure these animals' well-being, has previously studied wildlife around the Chernobyl site and, more recently, around Fukushima as well. His findings, including birds suffering sterility and cataracts and reduced abundance and breeding capacity among small mammals, contradicts the easy assumption that these animals, absent predatory humans, are thriving. We are coming up on 37 years since the Chernobyl explosion that spewed radiation across vast areas of the former Soviet Union and into much of Europe as well. Customarily, we focus our commemoration on the human toll and the warning this sends for future such suffering to come if we don't abandon nuclear power. But, as Mitsue Kano observes, we bear responsibility not just for what we do to ourselves, but also for the harm and the pain we inflict on the animals who share this planet with us. It is time to ask ourselves what right we have to destroy their lives along with ours in the foolish pursuit of such a futile and fatal energy source. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat, and that's this week's hot story.
We'll have this week's featured interviews in just a moment, but first, the nuclear industry never lets up with their propaganda, using talking points, op-eds, talk show bookers, and other tactics to brainwash our politicians, reporters, and the public into giving them whatever they want, which is money, 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 and more money. And let's face it, they already have all the money in the world to fund their PR agencies and their agenda. It's a business model with a terrific ROI, return on investment. Because whatever millions the nukesters spend on their public relations propaganda, they stand to get billions of dollars back from taxpayers. That's just one of the reasons why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. For 12 years, this show has been one of the only places where you can get an honest one-hour hit of nuclear information. Interviews with genuine experts, a roundup of international news, numbnuts, the hot story, bad puns, a touch of musical theater. Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to the nuclear industry lies? But up against that industry's unlimited financial resources, this show operates on a bake sale budget, which has limited us. Our budget is dependent on you, the listeners, to keep us going. That's why, if you value Nuclear Hot Seat's work, the time to support us with a donation would be right now. So join us. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, follow the prompts, and help us with a donation of any amount, be it one time only or a recurring monthly donation. Give what you can now, and know that however much you can help, you are helping. And I'm deeply grateful that you're both listening and that you care. Now here are this week's featured interviews. Irwin, Tennessee is a small town with a big problem. Nuclear Fuel Services Incorporated, known as NFS, a company that since the 1960s has been a major supplier of fuel for the U.S. Nuclear Navy. In recent years, it has also reprocessed weapons-grade uranium into nuclear reactor fuel, which has impacted the health and safety of the people and the environment. Now, the U.S. government has granted NFS $57.5 million U.S. dollars to refine uranium into thermonuclear bomb-grade material. A bad idea from so many different directions that the local citizens' action group that opposes the plant has been fighting back hard. One of their most inspired moves was to put together a sterling group of experts for a one-day people's hearing for nuclear awareness. So what are the problems faced in Irwin, Tennessee? To find out, I spoke with each of the panel participants to get their input on the legalities, contamination, health dangers, and morality of this move to expand our nuclear arsenal, as well as gain some insights into what we can do to stop this from happening. They are, in order of appearance, Attorney Terry Lodge, Dr. Michael Ketterer, Mary Olson of Gender and Radiation Impact Project, Patrick O'Neill, who is one of the nonviolent Kings Bay Plowshare 7s protesters, and Mare Inouye, Esquire. We start with Terry Lodge, and we spoke on Monday, March 27, 2023. Terry Lodge is an environmental and civil rights lawyer representing protesters opposing nuclear power and nuclear weapons, mountaintop removal, fracking and its radioactive waste, and war. He has been working with the Irwin Citizens Awareness Network. So, Terry, tell us, what is Nuclear Fuel Services? What is the current situation there in Irwin, Tennessee? And what are the local citizens up against?
Nuclear Fuel Services is a lending facility. It's located in Irwin, which is a town of about 5,000, nestled in the eastern Tennessee mountains. It's approximately 18 or 20 miles south of Johnson City. Irwin is a community of about 5,000 for probably 65 years or so. NFS has provided extremely well-paying jobs by the hundreds on an installation in Irwin where their primary activity has been to either downblend nuclear weapons material to a somewhat lower concentration of uranium-235 for use as submarine fuel or for use in surface warship nuclear reactors. In other words, for the nuclear Navy, they've occasionally had other contracts that are not well detailed or understood. The plant, as my friend Dr. Ketterer illustrated again today, the plant has emitted measurable radioisotopes over the years, and there is a probability, I would say, that an awful lot of the health problems, particularly cancer rates in Irwin, are influenced negatively by the fact that the plant continues to operate. There are radioisotopes contaminating groundwater flowing onto the site. Dr. Ketterer has verified the presence of plutonium that is fingerprinted and identified as coming from the plant 95 miles downriver on a very lovely scenic riverway in eastern Tennessee, the Nolichucky. And there is some evidence that suggests that past contamination events, air contamination from the plant, has even migrated eastward toward North Carolina. Today was a very interesting event. It was a gathering of peace and justice people from throughout the Southeast, the Carolinas, Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, and points further south. There were about 65 or 70 in attendance. The principal starting topic was to talk about litigation that I've been working on with the Irwin Citizen Awareness Network, which is an interesting, scrappy little group of people who, as grassroots activists often are, become both wonkish and professorially expert in what they learn and expose about the things that they discover. These people are fiendishly creative, but they keep incredible records. They have documented a massive array of unusual instances and events that could or have actually been suggestive of hyperactive radioactivity problems, criticality events. And the NFS plant is privately owned and operated. It's not a federal government facility per se. They contract with the federal government, but there are some interesting legal implications that flow that actually militate in favor of weaker regulations in terms of quality assurance at the plant.
What has been done to communicate with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission? Do they have any kind of jurisdiction over this? And yes, if so, what has been their involvement? What has been their response?
What is actually currently at issue is that about 2 years ago, the plant and DOE, the Department of Energy, announced, and the NRC announced that there was going to be a $57.5 million contract to install a new product line at the plant. The product line will refine already highly enriched uranium and we're talking in excess of a 90% enrichment threshold. It's a purification process to remove other radioisotopes other than uranium. The new product line at NFS is going to be a replica of an existing refinement line at Oak Ridge at a DOE-owned facility called Y-12. This facility and this product line at Y-12 purifies highly enriched uranium for use in nuclear weapons. This is supposed to be a backup facility, and I won't go into the ridiculousness from a taxpayer standpoint of having a redundant facility. But the point is that for a number of years, I think a decade, this product line at Y-12 has produced and admittedly produced nuclear bomb material. NFS denies that they are going to be making nuclear bomb material from this line. There are two or three authoritative industry watchdog newsletters, and these aren't activists. This is industry insider journalism sorts of newsletters, Defense Daily being one, the Exchange Monitor being another, that have stated in their coverage of this contract award that it's nuclear weapons, it's bomb material. NFS's union, there's a steelworkers local in Irwin, in their newsletter proclaimed proudly when this contract was announced, we're going to be making nuclear bomb material. Yet we filed a petition in October of 2022 requesting a hearing on four different issues. The principal and most important ones were, we were demanding environmental impact statement type of overview and assessment of decades of legacy and ongoing contamination of groundwater flowing underneath the site, and that there needed to be, in conjunction with that, some sort of a deep assessment of damage that was ongoing to the Nolichucky River. It's a very popular kayaking, canoeing, and fishing river, depending on time of year and flow and all that. But we also were asking for an environmental impact statement discussion of the nuclear weapons proliferation effects from adding this product line, making it redundant, but also doing it in a private plant that isn't subject to the same quality assurance regulations as the Department of Energy requires at Y-12. Quality assurance is really important because the plant at NFS is dealing with a liquefied form of highly enriched uranium. And as I say, if you allow accidentally concentrations of it to form as the material is moving through a line, you can have nuclear criticality events that can be even fatal. They can have very, very serious medical consequences for workers in the vicinity who are subject to the flash. So we are demanding a nuclear weapons proliferation assessment because we believe, number one, that they need to be honest with local people that, yeah, we're making nuclear bomb material, because among other things, there are possibly international law violations that flow from that. But also, we're talking about a different possible set of risks, a different possible set of skills that the employees are going to have. And given the historic and growing medical evidence that the community has experienced contamination of air and water and soil, we think that the public deserves some sort of chance to explore technically and have their own experts duplicate or even surpass any research that appears in the current license amendment that's proposed by the plant.
So has the NRC held hearings? Do they have this under consideration? Where does it stand with them?
Where it stands is we had an oral argument in mid-December of 2022 where the NRC was allowing the plant and the Nuclear Commission staff and us to argue as to why our four contentions should be afforded a chance to go to trial, to be heard in the course of a trial. All four of our contentions were denied. The petition was dismissed. But interestingly, NFS's attorneys flatly denied in writing in their filings that they were going to be making nuclear weapons material. I attempted to raise a fuss about it, pointing out that there is a great deal of mainstream credible media, including some very angry public officials at Oak Ridge, who are angry that the DOE is duplicating a line and basically taking jobs away from Oak Ridge, which has been dutifully reported by local press in the Knoxville, Oak Ridge area. So I raised something of a fuss at the hearing. The lead administrative judge did go performatively, I think, through a series of questions of the attorney from NFS, who kept saying, no, we are not making nuclear weapons. Any discussion, any conclusions to the contrary are false and totally unfounded and all this other garbage. And finally, the administrative judge got him to admit that, okay, DOE is going to give us specifications as to how refined, basically, the characteristics of the material they wanted. And we don't know what they will be doing with the stuff that we manufacture. So as I was telling the people today, and as I commented in December at the hearing, so it's don't ask, don't tell. It's just another one of these lies to a community that has never been told exactly what is going on. When the ECAN people that I represent, who have for two decades been attempting to out a lot of truth for change, they are typically stonewalled, patronized, the things that happen to dedicated activists who know more than the people that they're asking questions of, or at least they know the answers and want public acknowledgments. So it's not happening. We are appealing the dismissal of the petition to the full commission, the Nuclear Regulatory Commissioners. I'm not at all optimistic that they will order a different resolution. I don't think we're going to get a hearing. I think that we are pretty much at the end of the road, as unfortunately is most often the case with the NRC.
Michael Ketterer is currently Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Northern Arizona University and was formerly with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Enforcement. Michael, as Terry mentioned, you have also been involved in this case. What are the environmental costs of having Nuclear Fuel Services purify uranium for thermonuclear weapons?
The Nuclear Fuel Services facility in Erwin, Tennessee has released enriched uranium and plutonium and possibly a wide variety of other substances. They've been released into the environment, into the air, and also via contaminated groundwater, as well as direct outfall discharge. They go into the Nolichucky River, which runs right by the site in Erwin, Tennessee. And so there's multiple contamination pathways, and we have found off-site contamination in a lot of areas.
How far away are some of these areas where you have found the contamination?
The contamination appears to go all the way down the Nolichucky River, a 95-mile length of river course, to where the river ends at a large TVA reservoir called Douglas Lake. In 2011, I took sediment cores from essentially the mouth of the Nolichucky River and confirmed that enriched uranium was present in those sediments. And that finding says that the entire course of the river has received contamination from dissolved substances in the water. These are emissions from Nuclear Fuel Services. The enriched uranium is an unequivocal identifier of that.
So each of the radionuclides has a particular fingerprint or DNA, as it were, that identifies it with the source where it was created. Is that correct?
The way to look at it is uranium consists of a mixture of isotopes, and the relative distribution of the isotopes is a characteristic or a fingerprint of where it came from. So as is the case in other sites like the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, enriched uranium is characterized by you have more uranium-235 in the sample than you should have in nature. And so that's what we're using as an indicator of this is impact from Nuclear Fuel Services. For example, in soils in and around Erwin, we find enriched uranium is deposited in the soils. It's in the sediments in areas near the Nuclear Fuel Services facility. It's in the Nolichucky River sediments. It's in the water. It's pretty much anywhere that the contamination will have gone, one could find enriched uranium. And that conclusion is just simply made by comparing the proportion of uranium-235 and 238 atoms.
Is this data that you have presented to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or Nuclear Fuel Services or perhaps the EPA?
Interesting you act that, Libby. In June of 2014, I met with the then commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, Allison McFarland at the time. A meeting was arranged in Irwin. I was in Irwin to do a variety of things, but a meeting was arranged and we sat at a conference table and I presented essentially all these results to the chair of the NRC. And her reaction was, I would say, very patronizing. Oh, well, that was an interesting experiment. Why don't you do this with it? And it's basically, you have found an interesting tracer and it could be useful in geology, but her opinion about the significance of the contamination was very much, this is not of concern whatsoever to us.
Mary Olson is an evolutionary biologist, founder of Gender and Radiation Impact Project, and retired radioactive waste specialist for Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Mary, you are well-versed, ultimately well-versed, on the impact on health posed by radiation exposure. What could or does the public in and around Irwin, Tennessee, and beyond, face from the radioactive materials created and released by the uranium purification process?
Okay, so let's talk about the fact that Irwin has over 40 years of exposure to the community of processing plutonium for fuel production for the submarine fleet. And the reason I need to start with that is that the uranium processing is proposed and the community is uniting to ensure that that process never happens here, because there's been so much suffering, so many cancers, so many other types of less than wonderful health in the Irwin community, particularly the fact that homes are right across the street from the facility. I have been up a small hill where homes' front windows are higher than the stacks on some of the industrial operations at Nuclear Fuel Services. There's absolutely no question that people are being exposed to whatever Nuclear Fuel Services does. Mike focusing quite brilliantly on the water discharges, but there's absolutely certainly air discharges and groundwater impacts. So there's a whole portfolio of ways in which people are suffering from some of the most deadly elements that do not occur naturally on Earth in industrial quantities, specifically plutonium, americium, neptunium, all the things that are heavier than uranium that don't belong on a planet with carbon-based life forms, depending on DNA to keep us functioning bodies and making good, healthy babies. So let's be clear, this is a decimated community. This is a community that makes me cry every time I come to visit, because it is so much a poster child for what we call the front lines of the nuclear weapons world, because the nuclear submarines are the delivery systems, right, for the nuclear arsenal. There are other ways that nuclear weapons are housed and launched and ready to go, but the submarine fleet exists for the purpose of being the deep water launch for our arsenal. So all of that said, now you're going to probably ask me some questions about other details. Go ahead.
What, if any, tracking of health statistics have been compiled from the people in Irwin? Is there any kind of epidemiology that has been done to prove or to show the increase in the diseases that are linked with radiation exposure?
Yes, there has been epidemiology done, and it is primarily the survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki A-bombs that the United States, in its moment of probably worst decision ever, decided to use the first weapons on cities full of people. And that's where we have a group of people, horribly, over 100,000, who are subscribed into a study. Epidemiology is not something you can do with a tiny little town like Irwin, nor should we expect to do it in a tiny little town like Irwin. It is a false weapon of the nuclear industry and their shills in government to say we have to prove each time that radiation is harmful. We know radiation is harmful. We have already proved it, and we should be taking the findings from other places where there's larger numbers and applying them in Irwin, just like all my colleagues who work on climate, and I thank them so much for their work. They say that every asthma and every bronchitis should be counted as impacts of carbon emissions. Well, I think that the people of Irwin should not be required to prove their illness. However, I will point out that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission was funded to do a study, and they enlisted the National Academy of Science, and they started a pilot program. They were looking at 7 or 8 communities in the United States to kind of figure out how they were going to approach this, and Irwin was one of those communities. The stated reason for canceling that study was that $4 million was too expensive for phase two. I believe they came, this is my humble personal opinion, but I live in this area and I saw this all unfold. And I honestly think they came to Irwin and were so shocked, so incredibly overwhelmed by the degree of disease and numbers of deaths that they just canceled the whole U.S. national study because they didn't want to report the findings that they got here and in a couple of the other places that they went to initially. So fuel factories are dirty, nasty business, and plutonium fuel factories are the dirtiest, nastiest business. And now they want to add an additional dirty, nasty business with highly enriched uranium that's currently being done at a DOE site not that far away here in Tennessee. There's no reason they need to have a second place where they are going to process uranium like this, and they haven't started, and the community is united. They do not need additional exposures.
Patrick O'Neill is a journalist and co-founder of the Father Charlie Mulholland Catholic Worker House. He's also part of the Kings Bay Plowshares Nonviolent Direct Action and other peace work, for which he has been imprisoned for over 3 years. Patrick, speak to us about the moral issues regarding the Trident submarine.
The Trident submarine is part of this triple threat from, well, actually, you know, it's kind of interesting with the Space Force now. We may have 4 different nuclear threats in the near future: air, sea, land, and then outer space. It's a horrible thing to contemplate that we've added a 6th institution to the military-industrial complex, now the Space Force. And so basically we have leaders in this country, in the United States, taking this incredible risk with nuclear weapons, knowing full well that war and stopping the climate disaster in the world can't coexist. And Trident plays a great role in that because it's the most diabolical weapon system ever built. It really represents the end of the human experiment. And I think the moral issue is humankind just has to figure out a way to live together in peace. We can't do this anymore. We can't take all of this technology and devote it to death in a world that is so imperiled by the consequences of our behavior and our technology. So the moral issues, of course, cry out to us, you know, because we wake up in the morning and we smell the fresh air and it's springtime and we look at nature and the beauty of it and realize at the same time that we have to work so hard to keep it. And as you know, Libby, I'm a father of 8 children and got 3 grandchildren. So I'm worried about the future of my children. I mean, a lot of my children, and especially my grandchildren, will be alive at the turn of the next century. They'll be here in the 22nd century. And I'm trying to think, you know, what's it going to be like, 77 years down the road, if we continue along this path? What kind of lives are humans going to have on this planet? So the fact that we're even talking about these issues is a horrible and frightening thing, that, you know, that this has to dominate the conversation, because we're all thinking about leaving this world for people, for other people, for creation. We're in trouble. That's the alarm we try to sound with the Kings Bay Plowshares. It's a dramatic witness, a little disarmament taking place. And we understand the Plowshares movement is basically theatrical and it's designed as a wake-up call. But we really want to see true disarmament come, and that can't come. You can't put the cart before the horse. We have to agree to disarm internationally in order for it to happen. It can't happen really piecemeal. It's got to be a point at which world leaders say enough is enough.
Kings Bay Plowshares was a direct action on the Kings Bay military base.
It's called Naval Station Kings Bay, in a town called St. Mary's, Georgia. It's right on the Florida border of the Atlantic Ocean. So it's right there, tucked into that southeast corner of Georgia. You know, Jimmy Carter brought the Trident to southeast Georgia. And I'd like to remind people, and God bless Carter. I mean, in his years since he left the presidency way back in 1980, he's been a good humanitarian and done a lot of great work. But if the weapons that he brought to Southeast Georgia are ever used, certainly Carter's legacy is going to be very tainted.
You've been involved with direct action, and it seems that that is something that we need to build upon or somehow make our voices more evident, more dramatic, more out there. What would you suggest that people do in terms of demonstrating their opposition to nuclear weapons or a specific situation like this in Irwin?
In Irwin, they're doing it. That was a cover-up, a government cover-up of a disaster. What could have been a far worse disaster? So what has happened now is everyone you're interviewing on this show has brought together the people in these communities there, Jonesboro, Johnson City, where we are today, Irwin, and they're working together to tell the people what the government wouldn't admit to. So that's a great example of grassroots action, in my opinion, when people say, okay, the government's going to cover up and we're going to open up the files and show everybody the truth and give them the data to prove it. So all of that kind of stuff, that kind of grassroots work is wonderful and important. But I think on a bigger level, we have to really think about as human beings, withdrawing our consent to what our government is doing. And to withdraw our consent means to non-cooperate. It might mean nonviolent direct action. It might be refusing to pay your taxes. It might be taking a stand in any way that you can to say no to war and the nuclear arms race. I guess we need to get creative. I mean, I think plowshare actions, I always compare them politically to the Boston Tea Party. And biblically, I can compare it to Jesus cleansing the temple of the money changers, which is theologically the argument that it was Jesus's last stand. You know, he was executed 2 days later. But the point I'm saying is that dramatic action and non-cooperation, you know, the thing is, we have military academies. We plan out for war. We spend billions of dollars planning for the violent solution. Not much is devoted to the nonviolent solution. If we believe in what Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Jesus and so many others have said about practicing nonviolence, nobody wants to try it. Nobody wants to try it because it's always an eye for an eye. People believe that's the way to go. But, you know, as Gandhi said, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind.
Mari Inoue is an attorney. Born and raised in Tokyo, she is a co-founding member of the Manhattan Project for a Nuclear-Free World, which is raising awareness about concerns in communities impacted by nuclear policy. So, Mari, how can we fight against this? Or what can we fight for that is going to give us a better future and hopefully get away from the impact of companies like NFS?
Thank you so much for that question. There was a very inspiring development which gave us hope from the United Nations. Last year, United Nations General Assembly declared that access to clean, sustainable, and healthy environment is a universal human right. And United States voted in favor of this resolution. And this is not just about the governments or international organizations. Corporations are also required to scale up their efforts to ensure a clean and healthy environment for all. So we should demand this. And second, we can also call for divestment from nuclear industries, which means that a move away our own money, corporate money or organizations' money, away from financial institutions that support nuclear energy or nuclear weapon industries that develop or produce modernized nuclear weapons and other nuclear facilities, because we don't want our own money used for this kind of investment. So every single one of us have a power to change. And once they don't have the money, then they are not going to support the business enterprise. And that's another way that every single one of us can do. Also, we need to focus our resources and efforts to promote the better radioactive waste policies, because there's this tendency that local people of affected communities are denied to speak up and raise their concerns. So we need radioactive waste policies that allow members of affected communities to engage in all aspects of decision-making processes, especially those whose needs were underrepresented in or excluded from traditional policy development, because their voices matters, and these nuclear policies directly impact the affected communities. So we have to continue demanding that these processes, decision-making processes, are available, including attending to the public hearing and raise their concerns to elected officials, to corporations, to government agencies that are trying to promote activities that are harmful to people and the environment. We also demand to protect the right to information and also develop radioactive waste policies based on precautionary principle and humanitarian perspective. The precautionary principle means that do no harm. And if scientists are divided as to the harm, then don't do it. Quite often, corporations do only cost-benefit analysis. They have to look into the humanitarian consequences of their actions. And we have to keep demanding that that is not the way you analyze their activity. So make sure that we call for precautionary principle from human rights perspectives.
When you talked about divestment of our finances, is that a reference to the program Don't Bank on the Bomb?
Yes, that's one. I don't think that in the anti-nuclear energy circle, we call for divestment like anti-nuclear weapons community do. And also you can talk to your financial institutions and ask them whether they invest in nuclear weapons or nuclear energy corporations.
Thank you, Mari. We will also have further information on the Don't Bank on the Bomb program in a moment. But now, while I have you here, all of you, I'd like you to offer listeners some more information on the Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, as well as ways that it relates to what's going on in Irwin, Texas. Terry, why don't you get us started?
Among the arguments we were raising that there needed to be a nuclear weapons proliferation assessment, which is a big gobbledygook term. We want an analysis of where NFS is contributing to the war machine, to the nuclear weapons complex that this country is spending $40 billion plus a year on. And over the coming decades, plans to spend literally more than $1 trillion in just renovating and expanding the arsenal. And all of this happening, of course, in the backdrop of saber rattling in Europe and serious talk about using nuclear weapons as though they were conventional means of carrying on war. So the Treaty for the Prevention of Nuclear Weapons is essentially in a partially ratified state. Every nuclear weapons holding country in the world is refusing to sign it. That includes, of course, Russia, Israel, Pakistan, the United States, France, Britain, China, and North Korea, and India. Those countries are not signing on, but what I think we're going to see is over the next few years, TPNW will be ratified and approved by a majority of countries in the world, but it won't include, of course, nuclear weapons holding states. But another important treaty that is often forgotten is the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968 or 70, depending on how you count it, to which the United States is already subject and is a signatory, and which in its penumbrous language dictates that no country in the world, even including the exceptional ones, is allowed to expand its nuclear arsenal. And in fact, an international court decision in 1996 requires that all countries are to take immediate steps toward permanent disarmament. It is a violation of international law, in my estimation, for any new efforts to be made to improve, modify, grow, expand, or even just clean up, refurbish, and put in new triggers to any of our nuclear weapons. My observation is that we are in a very dangerous time. We are certainly, according to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, we are closer to a doomsday scenario than perhaps we have ever been since the World War II era in terms of nuclear exchange. And the United States federal government is acting irresponsibly, to put it kindly, is acting ridiculously and bombastically and dangerously. But in a way that is highly profitable to a few corporations.
I think there's a real blackout in the United States on information about this new global treaty. It's at the United Nations. It came into force 2 years ago. It is called the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. I grew up hearing from 1970 on about NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. These two treaties together are now the global regime on nuclear weapons, and the TPNW, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So many people haven't heard that nuclear weapons are now at the UN illegal, and that is in force at 68 nations who have ratified the treaty. And it will continue to become in force in a larger and larger growing number of nations as what is called the universalization process proceeds. And I just want to tag here that you don't hear about this treaty on NPR, National Public Radio. You don't read about it in the New York Times or the Washington Post. There is like a blackout on this. And I think it's a certain form of arrogance that our society fosters, especially amongst the intelligentsia on policy, that if the United States isn't doing it, it doesn't matter. They said this about the landmine treaty, and it is the most successful treaty in the history of treaties. It has actually resulted in more reparation and addressing of, you know, ordnance that was out there from even World War I. People were still dying from landmines from that long ago. And there's been programs under that treaty to go out and find those and disarm them and really improve agricultural life worldwide. I mean, this is a positive, hopeful process. And the only two nations that never signed it is the United States and Singapore. And guess what? That's the only place that those two nations can legally use landmines is in the United States and Singapore. The rest of the world, it is illegal. So guess what? We as a people need to wake up and understand that we need to hold ourselves, each other, and our nation accountable for being the number one purveyor of nuclear weapons. We need to be accountable to places like Irwin that have suffered so much from the production and understand that the treaty needs to be strengthened because it doesn't actually include things like uranium mining or nuclear weapons production sites. And we need to get that in there. But this is the biggest source of hope. If we can just let it in and start talking about what is happening in the world with 92 nations having signed to make nuclear weapons as illegal as chemical and biological at long last and in my lifetime. Wow.
Wow, indeed. This has been just a glimpse at what the full conference was. And we will have a link to that up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode. For now, Terry Lodge, Michael Ketterer, Mary Olson, Patrick O'Neill, and Mare Inoue. It has been enlightening and a treasure to be able to talk to you this morning for Nuclear Hot Seat.
As for the program that Mare Inoue brought up, Don't Bank on the Bomb is a system for divesting funds from those companies that are actively involved in the design and manufacture of nuclear weapons. This brief explanation of how the campaign works is ably voiced by Susie Snyder. She currently serves as the financial sector coordinator for ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Susie previously coordinated the Don't Bank on the Bomb research and campaigns from 2013. This brief explanation was recorded at Dr. Helen Caldicott's Symposium on Possible Nuclear Extinction on February 28, 2015.
It's amazing. It's called Don't Bank on the Bomb. And that's the website, too, don'tbankonthebomb.com. Step one, find out if your bank invests in nuclear weapon producers. Step two, contact your bank. Tell them you don't want them to. Step three, tell the world what the bank says. And if they don't get rid of investments, go public, because no bank wants to look like a bad guy. It takes one or two people only to make a huge difference. And that can cut off the money stream to the companies that make nuclear weapons. You and I, we have more power than we think. and that power is sitting in our wallet.
And how can people find out whether the companies that we're told the bank is supporting have any connection with the nuclear weapons industry?
Well, we do a significant investigation every year. Now, it's not completely exhaustive, but we profile 28 companies that have association with nuclear weapons modernization and maintenance. And it's on our website, don'tbankonthebomb.com. And we really want people to use our information and contact us all the time. You can do that in, you know, through the website really easily. Contact me on Twitter, whatever works. And I'm happy to find out more. And if you find out, learn about more companies involved in nuclear weapons, tell us. We'll do the research and we'll make it public for everybody to use.
Love it.
I loved it when I first heard about it, and I love it still. Susie Snyder, who is now working with ICANN. We have a longer interview with Susie about the program and its implications and the progress it has been making. It's up on Nuclear Hot Seat number 454 from March 3rd, 2020. Check it out on our website.
Activists, shout out.
If you're wanting a movement against any and all aspects of nuclear and would like a role model of how to build such a movement, check out the Netflix movie 9 to 5. No, not the Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, Dolly Parton comedy. This is the story of women office workers in Boston, their movement, and how it built from 10 women who stopped complaining to each other and decided to do something into a national union. Grassroots activism at its finest. The film is well-made and instructional, illuminating not only successes, but mistakes and misjudgments that happened along the way. And by the way, the big-budget comedy didn't inspire this movement. It was the movement that inspired the comedy. Would that there would be more big-budget movies coming out of Hollywood that were opposed to nuclear. And a reminder that an easy hit of activism that you can engage in is to go to nuclearhotseat.com and sign up in the yellow opt-in box to get a copy of the show in your email inbox every week. You can go to Nuclear Hot Seat on Facebook and click follow, like, and then forward the link to a couple of people you think might be interested in learning more. All of this helps with the algorithms and helps the show be found online. It costs nothing more than a few minutes of your time, so please help us out. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 4th, 2023. Our thanks to Linda Pence Gunter for the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and deep respect and acknowledgement to our friend in France, Hervé Courtois, for all his work and kindnesses through the years. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information to me in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, donations are always appreciated, so if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help and will appreciate it. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023, Libby Halevi, Nuclear Hot Seat, and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program and the website. This is Libby Halevi, producer-host of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you to peacefully fight against nuclear weapons and the industries that support them. Take the money away from banks and financial institutions that invest in nuclear technology. Learn how by going to don'tbankonthebomb.com. It's easy and it works. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we're all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.